Thank you for attending session 328 titled Culture Clash, Postmodern Religious Identity Recreation and Modern Institutional Conservatism. Please silence your cell phones. This session is being recorded and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please consider making a donation to Sunstone and subscribing to one of our amazing Sunstone-hosted podcasts. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. So a little about this session. This exploratory paper seeks to understand the impact of postmodernism on spiritual identity recreation through the lenses of sociological identity theory and critical social theory. The author argues that the emancipatory nature of postmodern epistemologies on person and group identity recreation render traditional religious institutions such as the Mormon Church ill-equipped to appeal to postmodern individual and societal spiritual needs. This fundamental disconnect is explored through an analysis of rhetoric of current and past Mormon leaders and its impact on the identity recreation process. Finally, the author proposes criteria for successful postmodern religious institutions for further discussion. Kent A. Thompson is a PhD student, almost a candidate, at the University of Arizona in educational leadership. His dissertation research utilizes sociological identity theory to understand how new public school principals navigate and narrate their identities and roles under various neoliberal accountability regimes. 4 years ago, he entered into a faith transition from mainline Mormonism into agnosticism while working as a high school principal and serving as the gospel doctrine teacher in his ward. So we'll turn it over to Kent Thompson.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate you being here, braving a Saturday morning and braving something that has way too many ginormous words in it. I'm a teacher by trade. I'm not a lecturer. The podium up here is incredibly creaky, so I will be creaking around, I'm sure, at various points, and I do apologize for that, as I'm sure it'll come through on the audio and make it almost untenable at points, so I do apologize for that. It's interesting writing and thinking about this particular subject. I don't do religious studies as a point of order for my for the stuff that I do for my doctoral work. It's all inside of public schools and deals with identity and things of public school principals. But the reason that I'm in the idea of what happens to public school principals and their identity recreation and creation is because, as a principal, I went through a faith transition myself and was trying to figure out what in the world was going on with identity, which led me down the rabbit hole of asking some questions of my advisors and saying, oh, well, you should probably check these authors out. And then all of a sudden I find myself steeped in really interesting literature on identity theory and things like that. So as we go throughout today, I will read portions of my paper that I wrote in preparation for this only for clarity purposes. I look forward to any questions and comments at the end. Also, this is an exploratory project for me. This isn't something that... although I feel like I've done a lot of work on it, it's certainly something that I know that there are more aspects of things that I really need to be taking a look at in order to really flesh this out. My hopes eventually is to publish this particular paper in religious journals and things like that. That's my hope. It's kind of a side project for me. I am literally any day now going to hear back from my dissertation committee as to whether my proposal has been accepted for my final research to finally get done with my program. So I'm excited and terrified at the same time. So this is a nice respite for me from that headspace. So anyway, with all that. For me, the driving questions when I saw the Sunstone call for papers, really my questions that I started to ask was, how is identity created, specifically religious identity? How has identity changed? What effects does postmodernism have on religious identity? And how does this affect the Mormon Church and its members? Those were my driving initial questions. I did have some additional questions that came forth as I went through, and I'll bring those up as we go along. The outline, this is incredibly large and dense. Don't freak out, it's okay. We'll go through a lot of it very quickly. But I start at the macro level, and I really want to talk about the context of our current American Christian religious traditions. starting with the reaction, or starting with modernism, the Enlightenment, the reaction of that, and then postmodernism, the reaction of that. There's two tracks that the literature is very clear on with regards to what happens to American Christian religious traditions, and that is a liberalization and then a conservatization, which is the realm of fundamentalism, which is relevant a lot to restorationist traditions. And then after kind of setting that context, I want to take a look at actually sociological identity theory and what that is. I will say at the outset, sociological identity theory is not psychological identity theory. Those are two different realms and two different things. I won't be really touching on that. I'm going to be looking at sociological, which has to do with society and how individuals and individuals in institutions, reaction to institutions creates a social structure. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. Eventually, at the end, we'll talk about faith crises, and then finally, religious identity and the future of faith. So, social trends and religions. I'm going to just read a little bit here. Understanding the nature of human existence has been a question that has been and continues to be fiercely debated. These larger ontological debates have stirred humankind to create powerful monisms. For example, the Roman Catholic Church, that have stood as a powerful hegemony, only to be struck down, subsumed, and nearly obliterated when another monism, for example, secularism, takes hold. In the Western traditions, and relevant to the discussion below, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment represent a seismic ontological shift, resting the explanations of existence from a dogmatic view towards a rational and logical view. However, as we shall see, there is a folding and intermingling of ideas between these two visions of reality that seek out absolute truth. Religious traditions have long adapted to prevailing social theory, albeit slowly. For example, the monolith of the Catholic tradition and its cousins, born under the Protestant Reformation, itself rife with internal debate and struggles for absolute truth, lurched forward towards a more rationalistic view of belief over time, despite its powerful institutional prowess of condemnation of scientists, for example, early on with Copernicus, and thinkers such as Luther and Tyndall. Enlightenment scientists and thinkers looked for ways to rationalize their faith through reason, logic, and experimentation. For example, Newton, between his myriad scientific discoveries and accomplishments, obsessed over figuring out the exact date and time of the end of the world, utilizing his command of mathematics to analyze Solomon's temple, the measurements of Solomon's temple. The folding of dogma and reason came to dominate modern mainstream Western religion and can be seen in various apologetic approaches to modern religion. So modernism, which is one of the terms used to describe what happens with the Enlightenment, really, again, explodes into the world stage in the 17th century, replaces pre-modern appeal to faith with an appeal to reason. Further, the Enlightenment or modernity was a secular movement that sought to stop the demystification and the desacralization of knowledge and social organization in order to liberate human beings from their chains. I'll go back. Go ahead. What's really interesting to this for me is all knowledge before the Enlightenment, before the pre-Enlightenment and the Enlightenment, was held behind two large walls, and that was the religious tradition. For example, with the Bible itself being only available in archaic languages, not in the vernacular, that was a struggle for a long time. That knowledge and was behind the wall of the church. Other things were behind monarchical walls, right? So there's a struggle throughout the 15, 16, 17, 1800s for wresting control of government from absolute powers to some sort of power derived from a mandate from the people. And this all occurs during this same time period. It's all part of the same project. So the tenets of modernism is that there is an absolute truth. One, the absolute truth exists. Two, it can be discovered through experimentation and reason. And three, it can be dispatched to dispel all untruths. So we see this played out across all kinds of different ways and things within inside of the religious traditions. However, to push us forward, we do see that there is a dark side to modernism. For example, the lived realities of the modern societies with its cold application of reason towards a rationalism proved problematic as it birthed the horrors of the world wars of the 20th century. Here's a really good quote. The fact that art, intellectual pursuits, the development of natural sciences flourished in close spatial temporal proximity to massacre and the death camps has raised for many doubts about not only modernity's self-assurances, but about all of Western culture, has raised the issue, why did humanistic traditions and models of conduct prove so fragile a barrier against political bestiality? So what is postmodernism? Postmodernism is a reaction to these realities of modernism. There's a lot more that I go into in my paper, but I'm going to quickly skip over it. Modernism, there are groups, the transcendentalists, the romantics, who really push back against this idea of the cold modernity, which is free from feeling, free from all these different things. So there's different reactions to it. Really, not until the 1970s in Western culture do you get this real movement of postmodernism. There's a lot of other movements at the same time that are going on. But really, and I'll again go through these couple of quotes here, postmodernism attacks the very core of the modern project, questioning the existence of any truth, universal or otherwise, and the ability of human reason to find it. So where there were absolute truths, now they're saying there's lots of different truths. So postmodern, and the second quote here is a real crux to this paper. Postmodernism rejects any claim of absolute truth as an attempt to impose one worldview over another. This is the important part. It's not just that there are multiple truths, it's that no truth should be able to impose their will on other people or other groups or other ideas. Further still, postmodernists hold that the truth is not out there waiting to be discovered. What human beings take to be truth is something that we ourselves have constructed. And this is really important when I get into the identity theory concept and idea of how we construct what our identities are. So what effects does this have on the American Christian religions? Caveat very quickly, I'm talking about a very narrow band here. I'm not talking even about Western Europe at this point. I'm definitely not talking about Islam. I'm not talking about any of the other belief systems around the world, dogmatic belief systems. This is simply about these particular American Christian religions. There's a unique reason why that is. Part of it is because I'm focusing ultimately on the restorationist traditions, which then come out of these Enlightenment ideals of American Christian religions. So I'll read this quote for you. Religion in American society has also harbored an individualist temper, inimical to institutionalism. This penchant for religious establishment sees established religious institutions as inherently alienating. It is an orientation that has roots in the Protestant theological tradition and the post-Enlightenment adulation of self-interested individualism. These have promoted religious populism and suspicion of authority, religious or otherwise, and encouraged demands for dispersal of power in all spheres of American social and cultural life. This individualism inside the United States is paramountly important. One of the things that's interesting to me is to see how this plays itself out in early Mormon church history. Early Joseph Smith teachings, the early church is very egalitarian. It's not until, and everybody can receive revelation, it's not until there's some contradictions that an establishment is created of an institution. I'll talk more about that a little bit later. Getting a little ahead of myself. So postmodernism here has entailed secularization and a drop in traditional religiosity. This trend started with modernity is compounded with postmodernism, whereas the former rejected the tyranny of tradition and faith and thus absolute authority of religious institutions in favor of reason, the latter rejects truth itself with a much more staggering consequences for religion. So normally, as a teacher, I would ask you at this point, what do you think would be the differences? And you can think in your head of some particular things, so you can think about that. You'll never get the teacher out of me. All right, so there are a couple of different authors who really spoke to the concepts and ideas of what basically occurs and happens. There are two strands that we see develop out of this clash with modernism and postmodernism. One, we have the liberal developments. The next one is the fundamentalist or the conservative developments. So a particular author here, Dinges, categorizes the effects of postmodern sensibilities on religion in four developments. They are the loss of institutional salience, the cultural uncoupling of spirituality from religion, the loss of institutional control of religious symbols, and the rise of transdenominationalism. Word, really love that word, by the way. Gave me all kinds of errors. So one of the things, the loss of institutional salience, this is the idea that this particular author refers to members of these churches. You see them in mainline Protestant churches. He refers to them as lay liberals. These are individuals who do not subscribe anymore to the idea of there being an absolute truth, that their church is the true church, But it is a truth that they can adhere to and belong to and be a part of. But they're not necessarily advocating for us versus them that you get with the idea of an absolute truth. Second is the cultural uncoupling of spirituality from religion. We see a rise in the United States of feel-good gurus. Honestly, Oprah is a big advocate. She's a spiritualist. She has many people on her show that are highly influential that has helped to uncouple the idea of spirituality identity from a religion where you normally in the past would have to go for your spirituality. This is another part of it. So the third one, the loss of institutional control of religious symbols. We see this with the cross. The cross, although still has some sort of meaning generally with people who wear it for something with Jesus, the idea of the atonement and all of those different things that are so attached within certain traditions become incredibly detached. It becomes a common popular symbol. That's just one example. And then finally, the rise of transdenominationalism. So this is like Joel Osteen. Think of his mega church. Joel Osteen is not a particular religion. He's not a particular creed. He is Christian. He has a massive following. And there are many mega churches all over the United States that have the same idea. So these developments, born out of modernism and then finally postmodernism, have really changed the landscape of what it means to be a religious person in the United States. However, there's another reaction, and this is fundamentalism. The literature actually ends up calling this a pre-modern project. So this idea of even before modernity, where dogma was the truth, this goes back to pre-modern. But what's interesting is, and explore here in just a moment, is the concepts and ideas that are presented end up actually utilizing part of postmodernism to make certain really interesting points, which we'll get to here in a moment. So one of the authors that I work with here, Wenzel, noted that throughout the world, fastest growing religions tend to be strict, sectarian, and theologically conservative. In the United States, such groups continue to gain members even as theologically liberal Protestant denominations struggle with relative absolute losses. What's interesting is when you look at, and I don't have the stats right in front of me, I apologize, so I won't try to make up a stat, I'll just tell you more or less. There are more people who do not identify as mainstream Protestant religion than they do mainstream Mormon religion. Mormon religion is hemorrhaging people, but not quite like the Protestant religions are. And I find that really interesting. Now, again, I'm focusing only on the United States here, but it's important to note that one of the fastest growing religions in the world that is strict, sectarian, and theologically conservative, anybody venture a guess at what that is? It's Islam. They are definitely a fundamentalist project. So postmodern thinkers, such as a person named Derrida, have promoted religious fundamentalism as a third way, as a way in which constitutes a genuine alternative to secular reason or modernity, which is so ubiquitous today. It does so without engendering nihilism, it's important, which is what led to the whole World War thing, while remaining consistent with what they take to be the genuine insights of postmodernism, that is multiple valid ontological and epistemological perspectives, which by right would include a religious one. The churches generally have to go back to some sort of authority and legitimization. This is a form of legitimization, even within the postmodern concepts and ideas. This is a way, and there's another quote that I'll put up here in a moment that'll make this point even more, but I want to point out the really importance of this, and that is if postmodernism says there is no absolute truth, all truths are relative to each other and important, this is a way for fundamentalists to say, yeah, exactly, my truth is just as important as anybody else's. In fact, John Milbank, back in the 70s, was a very influential postmodern religious thinker. And he asserted that everybody has his or her right to live in a non-secular world, that is, an ecclesial society. Christian theology will then develop as a result of communal practices of Christian living within such an ecclesial society. Only such a theology, argues Milbank, will successfully escape the pressures of secular reason, thereby also avoiding the temptations of falling into apologetics. And here, theology as the theory of a new practice, the church can position itself as a gaze at once above, but also alongside with or against other inherited human gazes. So what's interesting here is, and this is a real quick aside, the concept of apologetics. Apologetics is a modern project to explain religion. It's a way, and in the literature, Milbank goes on and really blasts apologetics and talks about how churches who use apologetics to prove themselves in a state of secular society and reason are inherently saying that secular society is more valid than their own theological ideas. And I thought this was really interesting. And before I read all this, I hadn't really given that a lot of thought. But I find that really just an interesting application of the idea of postmodernism. All right. So what are the postmodern effects on mainline Mormonism? I'm going to read a little bit more from the paper here. I'm going to go back a little bit to this idea of a gaze, the inherited human gazes. So this gaze reasserts not only the equivalency to secular society, but demands it. The form of postmodernism takes on a more anti-modern approach and re-embraces the pre-modern dominance of dogmatic thought and belief as a way to remake society, which today is seen as secular. It is important to note that this approach does not accept all the tenets of postmodernism, for example, the obliteration of all absolute truth, but rather utilizes part of the movement as a way to argue relevancy. While the aggressive pre-modern approach is apparent in modern Islam, it can be seen in other fundamentalist religious organizations. Examples of pre-modern tendencies abound within the restorationist traditions as envisioned by the Mormon church founder Joseph Smith, and really as embodied in his declaration of his role as king over all the earth and head of the Council of 50 in Nauvoo as preparation for governance after Jesus Christ's imminent return and obliteration of secular society. So, as if heeding the warnings of the liberalization that it covered earlier, the mainline Mormon church has aggressively pushed back against liberal developments and obliteration of absolute truth over the years that had plagued other mainline American religious Christian traditions by galvanizing church beliefs and practices into the what I call the Mormon institutional conservatism. This Mormon institutional conservatism is rooted in the focused voice of authority of correlated doctrines and messaging that came out of the various correlation committees under direction of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles since 1972. While much rhetoric exists in the cultural milieu and in the dusty corners of gospel hobbyists' dens, for example, Bruce R. McConkie's Seven Deadly Heresies, a recent Orthodox example of pushback will illustrate the overall point where the mainline Mormon church makes its stand against liberal secularization and postmodernism that has taken hold in other American religions. Found on the churchofjesuschrist.org website for youth is a talk by Oakes from 2010. Talking about the true and living church. This particular quote, he says, "I will speak about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as the only true and living church. In doing so, I know I speak against the powerful tide of what is called political correctness. The fashionable opinion of this age is that all churches are true." So note the postmodern ideas there. "In truth, the idea that all churches are the same doctrine, or the same as the doctrine of the Antichrist, illustrated by the Book of Mormon account of Korihor in Alma 30. That account was given to teach us a vital lesson in our day." Okay. I'd like to point out here that while Oakes is not just declaring the church, he is a member of the mainline Mormon church as the true church, as has been done many other times, by invoking the Antichrist Korihor as akin to those who hold modern and postmodern views on religion, Oakes presents a clear line drawn in the war of ideas, which I'll return a little bit in the paper or in the presentation. And I would be remiss if I did not round out the equivalence tactic with a reminder of what happened to Korihor in the Book of Mormon. Korihor, who sounds remarkably like a man of the Enlightenment, still 1,700 years in the future, is bound and brought before the chief judge, struck dumb by God after asking for a sign of God's power, forced to beg for food from house to house after being set free, and eventually trodden down even until he was dead. This declarative isolationist language is ubiquitous throughout speeches, lesson manuals, and scriptures of the mainline Mormon church and serve as examples of the continual fortress of Mormon institutional conservatism being constructed to combat the dangers of the world. However, strong social movements continue to assail this carefully crafted messaging and have led to controversial policy decisions and reversals and will undoubtedly continue to pull against the Mormon institutional conservative regime as hardliners continue to attempt to reassert control. And I have a couple different sites there from different talks by Dallin Oaks in the last few years. So contrast that with the Community of Christ. So in contrast to the hardline resurgent fundamentalism of mainline Mormon church, the second largest restorationist tradition has leaned into liberalization with their tradition, eliminating many of the truth claims central to their mainline cousins. For example, adopting views of the Book of Mormon as a non-historical document, allowing women to be ordained to the priesthood, and the inclusion of LGBTQ members in all aspects of leading the church. Whether the rebranding or retooling of fundamental aspects of the sect will ultimately stem the tide of losses remain to be seen. Nonetheless, the Community of Christ serves as an example, a successful example of the adaptation of liberal post-Mormon sensibilities within a restorationist tradition. The discussion so far has been a large overview of the macro issues of religious belief and organizations within the modernist and now postmodernist milieu, and challenges the adaptations that have taken place within larger organizations. However, little so far in this presentation has been discussed of the individuals who make up and navigate these various traditions and outlooks. In order to see what effects these competing paradigms have on individuals and their identities, I will now turn to another large area of foundational understanding, sociological identity theory. So sociological identity theory offers a framework for understanding identity, and importantly to this discussion, identity creation and recreation against and within the social structures individuals find themselves engaged. For example, this theory helps explain the process whereby society writ large, as well as movements such as institutional religions, are understood, constructed, navigated, and propagated. Hey, look, I just read that. Great. So at its core, really, sociological identity theory comes to this question, is what does it mean to be who you are? Now, this is a relatively simple question. If I ask my girlfriend's five-year-old, she'll actually give me a really large answer because she's a ridiculously smart five-year-old, but most five-year-olds will probably tell you their name. I am Kent. Well, what does that really mean? So the sociologists who were instrumental in understanding and coming up with the ideas that are here really root their ideas in the philosopher Hegel. Hegel his identity philosophy states that our mind interprets things in relation to the other, that we cannot know ourselves in isolation because our thoughts, values, and beliefs are derived from the cultures in which we live. This is hugely like the crux of what sociological identity theory is. These set of beliefs and meanings associated with them in relation to our context then become the basis for understanding and interpretation of who we are internally, our identity as meanings and motivations, and externally, the enactment of these roles. The majority of the work that I cite and look at and have become way too familiar with is two authors, Peter Burke and Jan Stets, and their very important book from 2009 called Identity Theory. Just as an aside, for me, good theory is easy to understand, difficult to master. I hope I can present this in a way that it's easy to understand, but note that I'm making some broad generalizations of identity theory here. There's a lot underneath the surface. So if you're interested in more information on this, I'll give you my information at the end, but also feel free to read up on it. It's kind of fascinating. So very simply, and I say simply, and this is a pretty big definition, but Burke and Stets describe identity as the set of meanings that define who one is. When one is an occupant of a particular role in society, a member of a particular group, or claims particular characteristics that identify him or her as a unique person. Really, again, it's important. Who we are is a set of meanings and motivations that we utilize to enact a specific type of a role. All right. Trying to catch up on my thing here. All right, so identity. Burke and Stets talk about identities can be broken up into three categories: person identity, social identity, and role identity. The person identity provides what's called the core self. This is who one is as a person across situations, across time, and across relationships. This is also known as the master identity. If any time your group identity and or your role identities aren't jiving with your core identity has to win. Or your core has to change. Talk about that in a moment. So that's your person identity. Second is the social identity. It's the group. It's a group identity that shares an interrelated set of perceptions, attitudes, feelings, and behavior that distinguish an in-group from an out-group. So religious organizations serve as a really good example of this. Then finally, a role identity is the internalized meanings of a role that individuals apply themselves and acquire meaning through reaction to others. And that individuals are socialized into what it means to be a member of religion. Importantly, they learn the meanings of role identity and interaction with others, in which others act towards the self as if the person had the identity appropriate to the role behavior. Think back to when I was a missionary. I had seen missionaries. I saw the badges. I saw them interacting with people. Until I was a missionary and in that role, I did not fully understand what it meant. And I will tell you, I didn't fully understand what it meant probably until I was at the very end of my mission. Then I really assumed the role of missionary. Professionally, this is the same way when I became a principal. When I became a principal, I didn't know what I was doing. That's always scary. I looked the part. I talked the part to the point where people believed that that's who I was because I was saying the right things. And then eventually I assumed the role of principal into my own identity. So this gets to the idea there of the interaction between individuals that create a social structure. And something called structural symbolic interaction, which is talked about. Again, I'm majorly just flying over these concepts that are really deep. So more about structural symbolic interaction. To the extent to which these meanings are shared, so the meanings of identity meanings, such flow of symbols and meanings serve to validate and reinforce existing symbols and names in the situation. Because there is never a perfect agreement between agents about the meanings of behaviors, the flow of symbols and meanings can also shift and alter existing names and meanings, so that to some extent they are constantly being negotiated. Commonality of meanings and understandings is always being developed and verified. Where the consensus is high, the resulting structure is more stable and rigid. When the consensus is low, the structure is more fluid and changing. There's lots of examples, but I'll use an LDS one. I grew up in wards with a bishop that was, I think, quintessential bishop role. And then my first married ward I was in was not. Very, very happy-go-lucky, kind of whimsical, whatever you want. And that was not what I was used to. I was used to straight down the line. We have a handbook, and it says everything you're supposed to do. And this bishop was like, cool, whatever. Whatever you want to do. And it was a real jarring experience for me. And it, so my social structure that I'd been used to suddenly became incredibly unstable. And it was really a weird experience. I'm grateful for it now, but I wasn't at the time. So that leads us to the crux of identity theory here and to what I really want to talk about here. And that is identity standards and verification. Let's see. So again, according to Birkenstedt's, identities which consist of meanings and motivations, they enact roles that interact with others through language, signs, and symbols to create and reinforce a social structure, like a religious organization, a ward. This interaction creates an identity standard within social structures in which individuals undergo a constant process of identity verification against the perceived standard. Simply, successful verification of the individual against the standard will result in status quo and high salience between the identities and the standard. However, repeated unsuccessful verification results in the individual either making changes to the individual's identities to meet the standard, which is the path of least resistance, or changing the standard, which is the most resistance, based on the needs of identities to verify to a standard. I'll go over this again here in a minute. Indeed, the entirety of identity theory focuses on this. Individuals must make a match between the identity goal or ideal, which is the standard, and the perceptions of the environment of the actual performance of what they're doing. So what does this mean? So think of it in context of a faith crisis. Identity standard of Orthodox Mormon. Something occurs in your own meanings, motivations, and your core self that changes. You're unable to verify to the standard. Well, you have a couple of options. You can discard the things that cause you not to verify. This is the putting items on the proverbial shelf to create a verification to the standard, at least enough to where you're not going insane. Sometimes the shelf gets so weighty, you can't, and your identity standard cannot be verified and validated against. You must find a new standard. Or, again, you must eschew what you've lost or thought that you've lost and go back and do this. This is an incredibly difficult thing. The religious or the literature here is very clear that what happens is when we feel this disconnect, there's an increase in stress and a lowering of self-esteem. Sound familiar to anybody? When I'm reading this, by the way, for the first time, I'm like, oh my gosh, they're talking about me. This is great. It's a lot of fun. All right. So again, faith crisis, identity crisis. So as talked about before, several factors inherent to the human experience of emotion, self-esteem, and stress become the variables that change the perceptions of various socially constructed identity standards through verification. These variables serve as really important data points when examining spiritual identity creation and recreation within and outside traditional religious organizations. So the Mormon institutional conservative milieu strongly encourages socialization into an ontology and epistemology of absolute truths. For example, the church is the only true living church. Joseph Smith is a prophet. The Book of Mormon is a historical record written by ancient American prophets and translated by Joseph Smith Jr., etc., etc., etc. Situated within the previous discussion of sociological identity theory, these absolute truths serve as the identity standard of being a member of the church in good standing. See the Temple Recommend question interview questions. When someone comes across something that challenges an absolute truth, Joseph Smith's polygamy, blacks in the priesthood ban, Book of Mormon historicity, LGBTQ policy, it may lead to the inability of someone to validate their identity to the standard, causing stress and a lowering of self-esteem, thus causing one to enter a phase of discarding the issue. While there are many ways to Mormon, the group identity of being a member in good standing of the mainline Mormon church has led to a suppression of alternate voices through official church discipline, like excommunication, or the threat of such discipline. I should note, however, that recent threats of church discipline towards more liberal voices have not resulted in excommunication. Here lately, I'm sure you're aware of that, which I find very interesting, and may be a sign of a shift in internal policy towards alternative voices. That being said, the pervasive nature of the Mormon institutional conservatism allows little room for those who stray from orthodox messaging. Hey, final thoughts, look at that. The emancipatory nature of postmodern epistemologies on person and group identity, creation and recreation, render traditional religious institutions, such as the Mormon Church, ill-equipped to appeal to postmodern individual and societal spiritual needs. It would appear from the rhetoric that mainline Mormon Church and most other restorationist religions, the Community of Christ as the obvious exception, really is quite fine with that, offering a spiritual home to a shrinking but devoted base of followers. As American religion continues to see large declines in members and attendance, due in part to the pervasive nature of secular and postmodern sensibilities, efforts in recruitment and retention must continue to shift and utilize the postmodern ideal of legitimacy of alternate truths and societal goals if these churches are to see growth again. Meanwhile, individuals, especially within the fundamentalism of most of the restorationist traditions, will continue to struggle to reconcile their identities between the two worlds of modernity, postmodernity, and faith. This presentation sought to establish a framework for understanding and further study on the effects of postmodernism on individuals' identities. I've introduced and explored the complicated and sometimes contradictory nature of postmodernity and modernity and the effects of Christian religious organizations, especially in the United States. I have introduced the basics of sociological identity theory to establish the interaction of persons to various social structures through signs, symbols, and language, and the constant becoming of the identity creation process. However, I have not more fully examined here and explored the depths of the theory that would better explain phenomena of faith crisis within fundamentalist religion especially. I hope to do that in a subsequent paper and a research project. Finally, stories of struggle within and outside of one's faith tradition regarding identity recreation are missing from this current exploratory paper outside of my own examples and need to be included in the future in order to bring shared human experience into this conceptual framework. Thank you.
Questions just come up and I just had a question. I'm sure it seemed like everybody else knows the answer, but other than Gina Colvin, what are the liberal voices that are not being successfully excommunicated, like in the church?
There are some local ones that haven't received any sort of large. Gina Colvin's the only national figure that I know of that hasn't been. And I would consider that an international figure, right? Did she end up resigning? Yeah. Did she? That doesn't surprise me. Yeah. Knowing what I know of Gina from all the podcasts. Thanks for letting me know that. Yeah, that would be the only example I have. However, there's been some discussion, and there are some local examples as well. I'm from Tucson. Local in Tucson, yeah. But there's definitely some talk about there being other people that have been sold to that just disfellowshipment will be where we go with you, which I think is really interesting. So again, I don't know that that's anything other than leadership roulette at this point. I can't see an institutional conservatism changing that. Yeah. If you come up to the mic, then the recording will pick it up. Otherwise, I prefer just calling out. So,
I think a fairly recent Mormons, I think it was a Mormon Stories podcast, somebody mentioned that there has been a directive come from the top to, instead of go to excommunication, go to disfellowship for apostasy or perceived, you know, disagreement with the men. So I had another question. So can you flesh out a little bit more, like, some of the aspects of conservative Mormonism that clash with postmodern?
Yeah.
Like, can you flesh that out a little bit more, and, like, the tension that people are feeling, and, like, what some of the, I don't know if I'm constructing this very well, but
that's fine.
Yeah, something along those
lines. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're asking me two different parts there. First is kind of more of the Mormon institutional conservatism. Like, what makes up that?
Yeah, what makes up that, and, like, how is this, like, broadening postmodern thing happening? Because it's happening with millennials. It seems like they're being born with this sense of, like, why are you saying there's a true church? Like, why is that even relevant of an argument to make?
Right. So the irony to this whole thing is postmodern arguments that anybody inside the Mormon mainline religion are making in and of itself are inherently problematic, because then it drives away those who grow up in that milieu, right? So I was born in 1978. I'm right at the crux where that started changing. My own intellectual background as a PhD student in the last 6 years has been firmly rooted in postmodernism, whereas people who taught me were firmly rooted in modernism. So this shift in the change has been really recent. And millennials, and then Generation Z, thank you. That's my son, Blake, right there, of Generation Z. Just graduated high school. We're not different at all in any way. But anyway, so back to your original question about the Mormon institutional conservatism. What I find interesting is that you've had these issues throughout church history. I think for me, there's three main eras that I think are really vital and interesting to understand. And that is the original idea of the Church of Christ, Joseph Smith, the egalitarianism, everybody receiving revelation. Suddenly, that's not working out well for an institutional religion. And so Joseph Smith asserts his authority as the person who can receive authority or revelation for the church. It's a massive shift and change doctrinally for them early in the church, and it creates the initial institutional religion. You have Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, Sidney Rigdon, others who break away from the church, come back, break away from the church because they can't verify their own identity that was created with Joseph Smith at the beginning of egalitarianism with an institutional church. So that I would render that was really a good one at the beginning. Then you have, and I'm just going to be very frank about it, you have the Brigham Young theocracy debacle of Utah and all of that that happened with that. But more modern-ish, you have Talmage versus Joseph S. Smith, science and reason versus faith, dogmatic religion. You have The Origin of Man, which comes out. Talmage does not believe that evolution is of the devil. He believes in evolution, but he's censured and not allowed to talk about these things. So that is another way of, again, rejecting modernity and pushing forward with a dogmatic faith. Now you have today, it's really interesting, you have the hardliners in the 12, Packer having passed, Packer being one of the big mainliners, Oakes, I'd say Holland to an extent. And then you had more of the accommodating to an extent individuals such as Hinckley and Monson, who are now gone. It's interesting to see who is going to fill the void of the more liberal side of the brethren and who's going to be continually on the more conservative side. So, and as I pointed out in my paper, and I'll expand a little bit more here, importantly to this is the concept and idea of the correlation movement within the church. So before 1971, 72, it's a kind of the Wild West. And as a missionary for me, and this is back in the 90s before the internet was really big, so we all passed around like old Ensigns and Improvement Eras, right, that had these really juicy doctrinal things in it, which were like, this is so cool, you know. Also going around my mission was Alvin R. Dyer's For What Purpose? If you're familiar with that at all, that is Dyer's essay on why blacks can't have the priesthood. And it was a doozy. It was so pervasive in my mission that a 70 came and visited, and the first thing he told us was, if you have a copy of this, burn it. Michigan Lansing Mission is an exotic, faraway land of Michigan. Yes, I'm from Arizona, so it might as well have been a foreign country. They speak weird there, too. But anyway, But what was interesting to me about that was it provided exactly what he didn't want to have happen, which was everybody who hadn't read it yet went, we have to read that now. So it's really interesting. So before 1971, 72, it's highly Wild West. Apologetics is running rampant. You have, I can't remember his name right now off the top of my head, the Book of Mormon archaeologist who found nothing and then left the church. Thank you. So you have all these things going on, and then you have the correlation movement of the early 70s, and we see a harmonic message that starts coming out, and it really shifts and changes things. So I remember going to gospel doctrine class as a young married and having the old guys talk, and they were very much the old school guys, pre-correlation. The last year that I was gospel doctrine teacher, those guys are gone. And now we have just correlated material. And that to me is the most pervasive to continuing the institutional conservatism. Is that helpful? Yeah. Okay, good. Did I address the other part?
What are the rifts that you're seeing now? Rifts
that I'm seeing now? I think it goes back to, and it's problematic because it's only if you're aware of it. I was not aware of John DeLynn and Mormon stories until I was going through a faith crisis, thought I was the only person in the entire world, and I Googled something and came across Mormon stories with Tom Phillips. I stayed up all night listening to the Tom Phillips podcast. What year? My faith crisis was in 2015. I'm not sure when the Tom Phillips was recorded. But that was the first time I had ever even stumbled on anything remotely podcast post-Mormonism. And that blew my mind, and it opened up an entire new world to me. So to me, you have podcasts, you have the Google, which exists as a really wonderful resource to just ask questions, and then you have that. I think that's transformationally huge. But like for me, as an Orthodox, true believing Mormon, as a historian, I was a history teacher, I never allowed myself to think questions that were that critical. I allowed myself to think enough critical that I could satisfy myself within the faith, but never enough to really actually examine things. And I just don't see yet that my generation will be able to continue to see that. Now, my son's generation, that's different. These kids grew up and are growing up, everything at their fingertips. And you see that, I think, with the reach out for the different talks that the brethren are giving and the live question sessions, which aren't live question sessions, are kind of ridiculous. But I think that they're making that effort to try to do this because it is a whole different world, even than when I was a kid, definitely when my parents were kids. So does that make sense as far as, I just really have a problem. I don't see that changing necessarily for our generation, but for our kids, I have a lot of great hope for that. So.
I started my faith transition perhaps about the same time you did, much later in my life. I had one daughter of my 9 children, rather than going to Utah State or BYU, went to the University of Utah, and what could you expect? She lost her faith. But after that, my Relief Society president, BYU daughter, started law school and hobnobbing around with the Greek Orthodox Church, which was very unsettling to me, which precipitated me getting into things and having to look for a dictionary to see what polyandry meant and things like that.
Yeah.
Retrospectively, I have a very different concept of God, but somehow, I interpreted fairly insignificant, what I'd call spiritual experiences, way overinterpreted them. But there is one thing that's happened, and that is when I am looking for a messenger, the messenger arrives, and that's you for me.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And I hope we can cultivate a relationship, but I remember I read Boyd K. Packer's Correlation Committee talk, and they talked about the enemies of the church, which I concluded is us.
Yeah.
And it was gays, feminists, and so-called intellectuals, and I thought every one of those is a losing proposition. So I'm glad to hear that. And I now have grandchildren coming home from missions and leaving the church. That's just what's happening.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that.
And it occurs to me, the church was founded in 1840 in a post-Revolutionary War, whatever, and it does not hold up now. So I'm glad to hear that. And again, if there's anything else I'd like you to articulate, what your hope is, you know, for what it would take to have the church become healthy.
Sure. I think that's different from what I personally want to have happen. Like, I want people to be healthy and happy, regardless of any tradition, anything. I don't think people can find that within the mainline Mormon church as it's currently constituted with the leaders that are there. There are liberal voices within the church that are very prolific and helpful to what, regardless of what your identity is. Again, that's inimical to the institution itself. And until there's changes made, think of the temple recommend questions, for example. You have to believe in the absolute truth claims and fundamentalism of the church in order to be a member of in good standing. You have to.
Or lie.
Correct. Yeah, sorry. I was also the person who could never lie to their bishop and thought I was the only one doing bad things because I was the only one not taking the sacrament as a teenager because the whole truth thing was really important to me. Found out much later everybody just lied, and I was like, oh, really? Anyway. So for me, the church really does have to cease being the church. It has to adopt a community of Christ type approach. It has to say, you as an individual are the most important. What can we do for you? Instead of, you as an individual are the most important thing, or the institution's most important thing, you have to adhere to what we say. And that's what makes you happy. Well, if that doesn't make you happy, it's hard to stay. That's kind of what I'm saying with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of narcissism there. Absolutely. You had a question? No, we talk about this. That's my son. We talk about this all the time.
It's fun to hear from a different generation.
Yeah.
Just one bookkeeping thing, or a couple maybe, and then a comment.
Sure.
I'm not a fan of apologetics either, and so I'm interested in that Harrison citation, which I didn't get.
Victoria Harrison, 2010.
Okay, but it's a book, it's an article.
It's an article, and it's called, let me go to it actually. It's up on the screen right now. So it's called Postmodernism, Thought and Religion, Open Traditionalism and Radical Orthodoxy on Religious Belief and Experience in the Heather Up Journal.
Okay.
I will give you my information. If you email me, I'll email that to you. Because I, as a college student, I have access to everything behind all the paywalls. Don't pay for it. I can give it to you for free.
Okay, awesome.
Yes, I did say that into a recorded thing that everybody's going to hear.
And just a real quick question to save my, I guess I should go Google this. Isn't there something post-postmodernism, and does it have a name?
So postmodernism is not a coherent social theory. It is a catch-all term for really disparate ideas, but basically can be boiled down to the idea of there is no absolute truth, and we need to move beyond the idea of there being one way, that there is a lot of different ways, and we all need to like play a little bit nicer together. That's the basic overview idea of postmodernism. So yes, there is post-postmodernism. There's anti-modernism, which is an offshoot of postmodernism. Yeah, we're in a post-post world, some would argue. Yeah. It gets incredibly heady. Yeah, Google that, and you'll just go down all kinds of rabbit holes.
And I cannot believe... one was... Oh, this is a two-pronger, I guess. What's the source for the Dallin Oaks quote?
Yeah, so Oaks is right here. This is the 2010, The Only True and Living Church, and it's found at that URL. Again, if you email me, I'll just email you the URL. But if you Google Oaks... The Only True and Living Church in quotes, you will find that article.
Was
and
that
it's
a,
on.
Did he give it as a talk?
And it was a talk given at BYU that was then adapted into the youth manual. This is in the youth manual. This isn't some obscure talk. And I probably didn't say that enough in the talk, but this is in the youth manual. This is not, again, an obscure thing that was said in the back room of BYU in 1978. This is like, this is something that is out in front and center and said, we are the only true church. If you don't believe that, you're core whore.
Okay.
Essentially.
And I can't believe I'm going to defend Dallin H. Oaks, but my mathematical, logical, and being consistent and honest requires me to, and I will look at it in context.
Yeah.
But, you know, when he says he doesn't like the idea that all churches are true, of course, you have to define true. Right. So I'm going to cut him some slack.
Yeah, he goes on to talk about authority. And things like that, talks about power. And then he very clearly at the end reasserts his belief that
this is the church. And I can totally defend to the statement, all churches the idea that all churches are the same, that's a very naive idea to think that all churches are equal in any sense. I mean, they have their nuances. They have, I mean, they're different. Some are Christian, some are, I mean, so I'm going to just defend those, that abstracted statement.
I think why I focus on Oaks is that he should know better. He's a former Utah Supreme Court justice.
Right, right. He's a lawyer.
Right, who understands words. Right, so his when Oaks says something, and especially when it's written to me, and I'm getting on my high horse here, but when he writes something to me, that is a logical fallacy of a straw man. It really bothers me.
Well,
because he knows better.
And what he should know better, even though he's not a PR guy, is that's a really offensive thing to bring up Antichrist and core heart.
That's why I use this as the example in the talk.
That's what I
really
can't forgive him.
Yeah, I was like, it's one thing, again, it's one thing to espouse, we are the only true and living church upon the face of the earth. Great, cool.
Right.
And I believe it, and we have faith, and God
but
told me it. That's wonderful.
Name call, but it's like, and
if you believe that all churches are true and you have these postmodern modernist ideas, you are like Korihor. Okay, well, again, what happened to Korihor, right? I mean, he eventually was killed. So that's great. That's, that makes me feel lovely and happy. Possibly, yes. We have another question here.
I'm having a disconnect in my mind. Happy and healthy is a good thing. The fundamentalist, rigid institution seems not to result in happy and healthy people. You said at the beginning, they're the ones that are growing, and the happy and healthy institution creators are dying. What's going on? People want to be happy and healthy.
This is the fundamental contradiction that is occurring.
Somebody in a recent, one of these things today, so the more recent data is showing that that's not holding up.
Within American Christian tradition, so, and as I was mentioning earlier, I don't have the actual stats, so I'm not going to try to quote one, but basically, people leaving the Mormon church at less of a rate of those leaving mainline Protestant religions. Less. Less does not mean like nobody's leaving. I mean, it's like it's a cascade and then a waterfall, if that makes sense, right? So it's really interesting. Now, I will just speak to this briefly because we are running out of time. Happy and healthy is contextual. I would have told you as a mainline Mormon Orthodox member of the church that I was happy and healthy. Looking back on it now, I was not. So it's all about, the key to sociological identity theory is about perceptions. When we perceive certain things, we are those things. When we leave certain things, we can see and we can reorient and say, well, that was different. That's how it was. It's complicated. just one more quick thing. Religious transition is complicated. Religious identity is complicated. What I've tried to do here is give an overview of items and try to uncomplicate it a little bit. But inherently into anything are the contradictions and issues. And the scholars all talk about it. These are contradictory trends, the idea of the liberalization and the conservatization and what's going on and how they're usurping different things and utilizing different things just to try to survive. And this has been a product and a project for a long time that they've been working on. So you had a... real quick.
A lot of people, what they say when they leave the church, they find themselves.
Correct. That seems to be something, and that's something that I want to research and get stories of people to get that data together. Thank you. Yeah.
I've got a two-pronged comment. I'll be as quick as possible.
Sure.
So I did all my academic training in the 90s mostly. I got way into postmodernism. I found it just super interesting, and I was passionately involved in various offshoots of it in the social sciences. And I thought this is going to change the world. And this is not just in Mormonism, this is in our society. The postmodernism, the postmodern critique and allied things and social justice critiques are not radically changing the systems of the world like we thought they would. And maybe they are very slowly. I hope very slowly. But I maybe because of my millennialist roots in Mormonism, I thought it was going to be more dramatic. But that's been discouraging, and I hear that a lot. Postmodernism is a bit out of vogue, right? There's post-postmodernism, all that stuff. And so the critique, I think, is very powerful. I really enjoy what you have here, and But I'm concerned that the institutions of the world, especially conservative institutions like the LDS Church, are just, they're just doubling down that postmodernism must be Korihor, must be evil. And, you know, and that's kind of said, I mean, there's a quote in the Preach My Gospel that kind of says that a little bit.
Right.
And so I'm discouraged by that. That's difficult for me. And but one thing that kind of helps me understand it is in, I'm almost certain it was, I can't remember which apostle. But if you read in the transcripts of the 2007, the Mormons, Helen Whitney, and it wasn't in the production, but it's in the transcripts, and that one of the apostles, Holland, I'm almost certain it was Holland, said, because he's a little more informed, they said basically, we are not going to go metaphorical. He was basically saying, you know, other churches and stuff that are liberalizing and such, you know, go to the metaphor, and we are not going to go metaphorical. And I think that's the issue.
Yeah.
Right? Postmodernism says it's all metaphor. It can't not be. Words only refer to other words. It's all cultural. It's all constructed. So it has to be metaphorical, and they're going to double down on literalism, and I think just everything goes from there. And so I think my sense is that Oakes and others are just like, well, this is what we've decided as a quorum, and that's what we're going to do. We're just going to go absolute literal.
Yeah, that's where at the end I said that this is the trend, and they're okay with that.
Yeah. So I'm curious. Okay, I agree with you. I don't know where that, I don't see that that can have a future. That only seems like it's going to crash.
Thank you for your comment. I really appreciate it. My last thing real quick, because we are out of time, is just simply remember the arc of history is long. The modern project to secularize churches took hundreds and hundreds of years. The arc of history is long. I have confidence for the first time as a post-Mormon. I have confidence in the world. It's kind of new to me. Before, it was just like, we're going to end in a hellscape. Yay. Jesus will be here. I'm excited. But now, I have a real hope for humanity. I really do. There's going to be problems and lurches and backwards. It's going to be messy. But I have faith in humanity. Thank you so much again for coming. Really appreciate it.